Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are few peoples whose intelligence I admire more and whose use of it for the public good, I believe, matters more than our first guest. He is Andy McCarthy, a former federal prosecutor who has become one of the country's foremost authors, pundits, commentators, and extraordinary resources on the nexus, I think of it as, between national security and the law. He is the author of myriad incredibly important books, including my personal favorite, The Grand Jihad. He is also to be found on the pages, or virtual pages at least, of National Review Online and PJ Media, as well as Fox News and elsewhere. We're always so pleased to have him with us. Andy McCarthy, welcome back. Good to have you, sir.
Frank, thanks for having me.
Let me talk to you about, first things first, I guess, an indictment that was handed down in connection with this brutal attack in New York City recently, involving a truck that was used as an instrument of murder on a bike path. I'm interested in particular, Andy, in your analysis of the charges that have now been recently introduced that I'm thinking for the first time, maybe I missed something, but for the first time that I'm aware of, call into play the whole racketeering body of law and what we do to prohibit that. Talk a little bit about that as it relates to this problem of jihad and whether it may be a new opportunity for us to try to roll it up in America.
Well, Frank, it seemed to me when the initial charges came out against the West Side Highway jihadists who killed 8 people, they were obviously struggling with something or to find something in the federal code that they could charge him with. And the dilemma I think they had is that, you know, murder for the most part is a state crime. It's not charged federally unless there's some federal interest in it. So there's like a murder provision in the drug laws, and there's a murder provision, as we'll discuss, in the racketeering laws. There's laws against murders of federal officials and diplomats and like. So in a federal murder case, there has to be a federal interest. The state murder case is usually much more simple and straightforward, because the only thing you focus on is the murder, that you don't have to show a particular governmental interest in it. But the problem, of course, in New York is that there's no death penalty. And if you wanted to make this a capital case, and if it's worth having capital punishment, this is obviously the kind of case that it should be invoked in. It has to be done federally. So I suggested shortly after the arrest that what they should be thinking about is murder in aid of racketeering, which is a potential federal crime. And it seemed to me to fit the fact pattern, because what we know about this Saifulo character is that he was hoping by his atrocity to get into the not only the good graces, but the an operational relationship with the Islamic State terrorist organization. And in fact, they put out a statement after he killed these 8 people and wounded 12 others, accepting him and designating him as a caliphate soldier. Murder in aid of racketeering is a murder that's done to either gain entrance into or maintain or increase a person's status in a racketeering organization. And under federal law, an enterprise, we usually think of this in terms of mafia families, but it's any, as the saying goes in federal law, any association in fact, whether it's a legitimate one or an illegitimate one, so it could be like a mafia family or a labor union, that conducts its affairs through what the law calls a pattern of racketeering, which could also include acts of murder. So it seemed to me that ISIS fits the federal definition for what an enterprise is, a racketeering enterprise. And what Saifullah was clearly trying to do was enter into ISIS. So happily, it looks like the federal prosecutors in New York saw it the same way. And that's how they finally indicted it when the case was charged formally by the grand jury a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, well, I'd like to think you inspired them, Andy. But in any event, they've came around to what seems like a sensible approach. Does it open up a new toolbox for us in dealing with, I would argue, not just the guys who are in the violent jihad business, but racketeering in kind of the mafia technique of, you know, controlling and otherwise exercising undue and improper influence on others, perhaps ultimately against the Muslim Brotherhood, which is operating in this country, as you've documented in your books and writings for years?
Well, I think, Frank, that this, it's an interesting question, because when we indicted the Blind Sheikh case back in 1993, one of the things, and this is probably because I was an old mafia prosecutor by then, one of the things we thought about was going the route of the racketeering laws on the theory that the Sheikh's cell in the New York area was a racketeering enterprise, as that's defined in law. The reason that we didn't go that route then was there was an oddity in the way the courts were interpreting the RICO statute, which required the government to prove that the organization had an economic purpose. And even though there's a fundraising component, obviously, to terrorist organizations, the economic purpose is not really their real purpose. A mafia family is very different from a terrorist organization. Mafia guys are in it for the money. The terrorist guys are obviously in it for something else. So we went away from that way of thinking. And then the courts, the Supreme Court, ultimately ruled that the lower federal courts had made an error in adding this requirement, because it's not in the statute. There's nothing in the statute that says you have to show an economic purpose. So it's certainly worth visiting in an appropriate case. The other thing we have to remain mindful of is terrorism law in the United States was overhauled in 1996. So if you're talking about international terrorism, and particularly international acts that are clearly committed by terrorist organizations, we have statutes now that are a perfect fit for that. The difficulty with this particular case is you're dealing with a guy who didn't have an operational tie, that at least that we know of, to the Islamic State, and was trying to get into the Islamic State and committed what would otherwise be domestic murders. So that's why you have this sort of oddball situation. But I do think that you're quite right, that to the extent that you have activities of something you can define as an enterprise hovering over the sorts of things that have to be done to make jihadism work, that the enterprise is a very effective legal construct for that. It's attractive to prosecutors because it allows you to prove up the whole enterprise, all of the criminality that goes into it. The reason that this concept was brought into the law was because prior to the 1970s, it was hard to charge mafia families because they thrived on disparate forms of criminal activity. And the law kind of counseled against, you know, proving up extortion, gambling, murder, all in the same charge or all in the same trial, because one set of crimes was thought to prejudice the defendant with respect to the other set of crimes. So the idea of the RICO enterprise was to make the crime actually belonging to the enterprise that made its living on these disparate forms of crime. So it was kind of a revolutionary idea in criminal enforcement, and I think it could be a good fit for terrorism.
This is perhaps down in the technical weeds for most of us, Sandy McCarthy, but you're a splendid guide in those weeds, needless to say. And I'm struck by it because I, as you know, we've been very concerned for quite some time about what the Muslim Brotherhood has been doing to put into place the infrastructure of jihad, specifically jihadist mosques that are used as training centers and recruitment and perhaps even arming of violent jihadists. So I will be very interested in your further thinking on this subject and writing on it as well. We have to pause for just a second. I couldn't be more pleased to say that Andy McCarthy has agreed to give us a second segment. So we will be right back with more. We'll talk about the travel ban and the special counsel right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We are joined by Andy McCarthy, better known as Andrew C. McCarthy. He is an author, a commentator, an analyst of great renown, and always a welcome guest here. And Andy, I wanted to turn to the state of play with respect to the president's efforts to restrict more jihadists from coming to this country. This has been known as a result of several executive orders as a travel ban. He, I think, actually described it as an immigration pause. It's been challenged in courts. Where does this stand now, and what should be done to try to prevent the kind of dangers that he's clearly and properly concerned about from metastasizing further here?
Well, I think, Frank, that the travel bans were well-intentioned, but they were counterproductive toward getting to the end that I think the president said he wanted during the campaign, and has indicated from time to time since then that he wants, which is to deal with the issue of vetting or screening aliens who want to come to the United States, whether as immigrants or under some other immigration status. And I think, as I've maintained for a long time, the travel ban was at best a marginal improvement, if that, in our security, because it only dealt with a very small slice of the problem regarding countries that the people who were doing the screening already knew were problematic. But in the meantime, the litigation itself forced the Justice Department into the position of having to defend the president from claims of anti-Muslim bias arising out of his campaign rhetoric. And as a result, they took, I think, foolishly the position that there was no desire on the administration's part to take religion into account in these screening decisions. And they're trying to show that the president is not anti-Muslim. And my view of it is, I don't think you have to be anti-Muslim to recognize that the jihadist threat and the broader Sharia supremacist ideology that spurs it is something that arises out of Islam, and that any effective immigrant screening process has to be able to vet for that ideology and try to keep it out of our country.
This does seem to be such eminent sense, common sense, Andy. You've talked about this in the context of looking for the mafia in Italian communities, because that's where they come from, and, you know, Irish terrorists in the Irish community and so on. And yet we've really stripped ourselves of this capacity, not just in this case, it seems, but unfortunately in a lot of others of law enforcement, intelligence, military-connected activities as well. So does the Supreme Court's, as I understand it, basic approval of this limited ban by the president or pause still hold, or are courts down the line continuing to obstruct it? And I know you were one of the signatories, along with myself, of a recommendation to the Supreme Court to talk about the thing that really matters here, which is how do we filter these folks out, and your thoughts on Sharia supremacism as that filter.
Well, let's say two things. First, the thing that we have to win on, and then where I think the Supreme Court is at. Having looked at this for a long time, Frank, the way I boil it down is that we have to win on one simple fundamental question, and that is Sharia supremacism a totalitarian political ideology, or is it religion? Because if it's a totalitarian political ideology, then we can screen for it and vet for it. We've done that in history, and there's no constitutional problem with it. But if it's deemed to be religion and just another strain of Islam that's as equally entitled to all the protections of the First Amendment as any other religion, notwithstanding that it purports to be much more than a religion, it's an entire political and legal system. But if the courts come down and say that, you know, this strain of Islam is a religion, then I don't see how we can protect ourselves, because I don't, you know, it's going to be very, very difficult to vet in a context that the courts find lawful. So to me, that's the hill worth dying on. You know, all this stuff about the travel ban is a distraction.
But that proposition isn't being tested so far in court as of this point, is it?
Well, that, yeah. And my point, Frank, is that it's not only not being tested, but we're being put in a posture that will make it more difficult to prevail on the ultimate question. So that's what I worry about. And as far as the Supreme Court specifically is concerned, the cases that are before it now, I tried to break it to people, including people in the administration, when the Supreme Court let the travel ban go into effect, or the so-called travel ban go into effect in June, that it was not the victory that the administration was painting it as, because in order, I think, to keep the court together and unified, there was a compromise made on the Supreme Court where they let the ban go into effect, but they created their own judicially legislated exemption from it, creating this kind of very ambiguous category or categories of people who, you know, supposedly have some kind of a concrete relationship with the United States that would allow them to exempt themselves from the travel ban and be admitted to the United States, notwithstanding that the president's made a finding that the national security of the United States requires keeping people from these particular countries out. So I thought it was something the courts had no right to do. That's why the three conservative members, the three reliably conservative members of the court, dissented from that. And I think ultimately we're going to be right back where we started from in the next case, which I expect will be on the there's already litigation and a restraining order challenging the president's final order, and that is certainly headed back to the court. And I think the court is going to have out and argue out and decide, and probably in a much more divisive manner than the June decision suggests, exactly whether the president can do this or not.
Yeah, which is something that you have, I think, quite rightly said is clearly within his mandate constitutionally and statutorily. It's just staggering that we're even still thrashing about this. Andy, we don't have time to do justice to this, but just very quickly, your thoughts on the status of the special counsel, the prospect that Mike Flynn may now be cooperating with them, what this means for the Trump team, and whether really another special counsel is needed to look at the matters that the current one seems to have a conflict of interest on, namely Uranium One.
Well, let me take the last part, because that's probably the easiest part. I really think that Trey Gowdy is right about this, Frank. This is what we have a Justice Department for. I mean, we don't need a special counsel to investigate, say, you know, the Clinton Foundation and Uranium One. In fact, we understood that the Justice Department and the FBI were already investigating the Clinton Foundation a year ago. The only time you have a special counsel, which as we're seeing day to day and our past experience confirms this, it's a monstrous institution. The special counsel, whether you call it independent prosecutor or what have you. And we should have it only when it's absolutely necessary. In the Mueller situation, whatever you think of that situation, it would be the Trump administration investigating itself, which is the problem. That problem does not present itself with respect to the Clinton Foundation or, you know, corruption activity, whether it's by Republicans or Democrats outside the executive branch. It's just this very narrow, unique situation. So I think absolutely we don't need another special counsel, but we need the Justice Department to get busy.
To do its job, indeed. Andy, we're out of time, so we'll have to come back to you on the Flynn question anon. It may become clearer in the meantime, but we thank you very much for your time today, and The great work that you do at National Review Online, PJ Media, Fox, and elsewhere, and I so appreciate you joining us. Come back to us again very soon. We'll speak with Kevin Freeman next about China's economic warfare against the United States right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined by Kevin Freeman, a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy, who is graciously contributing each week to our program. And through his work with us and his own outfits, notably globaleconomicwarfare.com, making really an outsized contribution to our understanding of the phenomenon and practice and implications of economic warfare, notably by the communist Chinese against us. He is the author of two best-selling books, which amplify on many of the points we discuss each week, Secret Weapon and Game Plan. And of course, his postings at globaleconomicwarfare.com are really required reading, I think, for all of us interested in this battle space. Kevin Freeman, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Thank you, Frank.
I wanted to start, Kevin, with something that's in the news today, which is the latest instance of Chinese hacking of American companies, three of them specifically, in the energy and data and the global positioning satellite system businesses. They have apparently made off with immense amounts of data, and along with it, wreaked havoc, apparently, in terms of the investment these companies have made, their proprietary information, their time and energy, and so on. What should the takeaway be from this latest instance of Chinese cyber warfare against America?
The latest takeaway is that we're in a global cyber economic war. We've been in it for years. The government just hesitates. They stop just short of declaring, acknowledging that we're in this war. And these charges that were brought, you know, they acknowledge every fact, but they don't put the pieces together and say this is an outright Chinese government-led intervention into our economy to steal our secrets, to steal our technology. And really, they're fighting a war, and we're refusing to acknowledge that it exists.
Just, I guess, to draw you out on this, this is not the first of these Chinese hacks. Surely it will not be the last. But in terms of the damage done and the benefit to the Chinese of doing this damage to us, can you give us some sort of shorthand for thinking about the magnitude of what the Chinese are up to and the degree to which it is harmful to not just the companies involved, obviously, or people whose data may be compromised, as in the Office of Personnel Management hack by the Chinese, but more broadly, in terms of the national interest, Kevin Freeman?
Well, it's very strategic. The hacking is very strategic. Keep in mind that China is a planned economy. They plan everything that they do. So to just assume that they're hacking to get credit cards or they're hacking. No, and these are strategic choices. For example, Trimble making navigation systems, Siemens, which is a massive German conglomerate, and Moody's Analytics. And Moody's is the one that does research reports on companies to tell us what they're worth, whether they get AAA credit or AA or lower credit standards. They've chosen these specific information targets for a reason. And if you go back to the OPM, the Office of Personnel Management hack, and you combine that with a hack of Equifax, you pretty much know every single individual in the United States government currently or for the past decade, and you know exactly who they owe, who they're related to. You find pressure points that you can then use to apply for blackmail or any other purpose. Same thing with Moody's. You know which companies are vulnerable. You know which companies are in need of cash so that you, if you identify a company that's strategic to you, you can go loan them money or buy them or buy a competitor or what. It gives them access to information that's extraordinarily powerful to undermine our economy and advance theirs.
And that is a high strategic purpose of the communist Chinese, to be sure. And we're watching, as you've made clear to us, Kevin Freeman, an awful lot of activities on the part of the Chinese to take advantage of such insights by buying up Silicon Valley. If they can't steal it, apparently they will buy it where they think it is in their interest to do so. Let me ask you, Kevin, about this UAE-based sovereign wealth fund, Mubala, it's called, that has just made a $700 million bet on further Chinese growth in their economy at a moment when a lot of other people are saying it's pretty sluggish and with their increasing debt issues may not be such a good bet. How do you see what the UAE is doing? And does this tie in, as you see it, to kind of the larger strategic play being made by the Chinese and perhaps others, notably the Saudis, with respect to replacing the dollar as the reserve currency of the world?
Well, absolutely it ties in, because the Chinese are making, not only do they make strategic investments in our country and other countries, the One Belt, One Road policy, always with Chinese interests at heart, but they also allow strategic investments in China that either compromise the person investing or they open opportunities for the Chinese to advance their interests at our detriment in many cases. And in this particular example is, if you allow someone to invest in, you then have access, for example, when they allow Apple to exploit their markets, Apple, you turn over your security devices and help us to understand your security so we can protect our citizen, and then they just absorb that into their collective consciousness. In this case, there's $700 million that's being invested by Abu Dhabi, which aligns their interest with the interests of China rather than the interests of the United States. So this large investment from a sovereign wealth fund is an indication that the Chinese are partnering with them. And we know through all sorts of other publicly available information that they're doing it with the express interest of undermining the United States position, because they know in the long run, that's how you win this global economic war. You prevent America from growing and you expand your economy so that you can build up your military at our expense.
Yeah. And as we talked about with Dakota Wood yesterday, what the Chinese are doing to build up their military at the same time that we are taking ours apart, it seems, makes that prospect very, very ominous indeed. Kevin, let me turn to one last item. There is some reporting out of China that may be indicative of a fraying of relations between the Chinese and the North Koreans, and I wanted to get your sense of it. The Chinese have stopped air flights into North Korea, ostensibly because of a lack of demand. I'm not sure that there's ever that much demand for flights into Pyongyang, but that's their line. They've also interrupted, at least for a time, access on the main roadway artery into North Korea from China. Are these telltales of the kind of pressure that we wanted the Chinese to bring to bear on the North Koreans, or are these simply explicable for other reasons?
Well, they're certainly bringing pressure on North Korea. If you remove trade access with China, North Korea is dead. It's a client state. They have no economic activity beyond that which the Chinese allow. So they're yanking the chain and saying, we're the boss here. Whether or not they're doing so on behalf of global interests or American interests, I would question that. Does China want to see a thermonuclear exchange between North Korea and the United States? Absolutely not. That would not be in their interests, not unless we were at war with China. So I believe that it's a positive step. But I think that we should be very cautious with before we assign good motives that it's beneficial to us. Clearly, it's beneficial if they yank the chain and they apply pressure. The question is, are they doing it for our benefit or for their benefit? And I would suggest they're doing it for their own benefit.
Yeah, I think that's the best bet when you're dealing with the Chinese. It's not out of love for us. It is all about them. Kevin Freeman, we have to leave it at that, I think, for the moment. This is, as always, a bracing assessment of where we find ourselves as a nation dealing with battlefronts that most of us are not even aware are out there, let alone are active scenes of conflict or warfare, if you will, against this country and its vital interests. This is why we prize so much our association with you as a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy, and also the great work you do, among other places, at globaleconomicwarfare.com. Check it out, folks. Kevin, we'll talk with you again next week. Up next, we'll talk with Russ Dallin of the Latin American Herald Tribune about the latest developments in the region he covers, including, notably, Venezuela. That and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are joined by Russ Dallin, a man we have the privilege of picking the brains of from time to time about areas of the world that deserve a lot more attention than most of us are giving them, and that he follows very closely as the president and editor-in-chief of the Latin American Herald Tribune. He is also a man who has done business extensively in Latin America. He has been involved both in this country and there in connection with the journalistic piece of this enterprise, but also the national security and public policy, as well as the financial side. So a terrific duty expert. We're always delighted to have him with us. Russ Dallin, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Secretary Gaffney. It's always enlightening to get a chance to speak with you.
Well, the enlightenment comes from you, my friend, but I'm delighted that we are able to spread the light. Let me ask you about Venezuela, because we must start there. You follow very closely, Russ, the sort of economic travails of Venezuela. It sounds as though there was something of a stay of execution. I don't know that it constitutes a commutation of sentence, but talk to me a little bit about this agreement that the government of Nicolas Maduro has reached with Crystalex. What's that about?
Well, it's interesting because Crystalex had been forcing basically Venezuela on the on its back foot by trying to seize PDVSA assets, including Citgo in the United States. And they had been progressing in that to try and pierce the corporate veil, which Venezuela themselves have muddled throughout the years, of a legal separation of Venezuela as a shareholder, but 100% shareholder of PDVSA, which is where they make the bulk of their money, billions of dollars a year, obviously. So PDVSA, which has ships on the high sea and owns Citgo in the United States, was not necessarily responsible to Crystalex in that Venezuela was actually the one who expropriated under Chavez the holdings of Crystalex, which was a gold miner in a region that is very rich in gold. Venezuela has one of the largest gold deposits in the Western Hemisphere. In 2008, Chavez had expropriated it. In 2016, Crystalex finally got a full judgment awarding them $1.2 billion for the expropriation by these malandros, and with another $200 million in back interest from the date. So a total package of $1.4 billion. And they had been aggressively pursuing Venezuela such that Venezuela finally felt that piercing the corporate veil and allowing PDVSA to suffer would be too much for them. So they settled in secret this month and buried it on Friday over Thanksgiving. But we were there following it, much to the chagrin of the lawyers in the room who were taking our name in vain. But we exposed it and found out about it, although the deal itself is hidden.
So if this is presumably good for the owners of Crystalex, does it have any wider benefit to bondholders or others doing business in Venezuela as you see it? And more to the point, where did the money come from? The government of Nicolas Maduro, as you tell us week upon week, is bankrupt. They've despoiled the country, despite the oil wealth and the gold deposits of the country, it's essentially bankrupt. So how did this get undertaken, Russ Dallin?
You're absolutely right. They are on the verge of bankruptcy and in default on several of their bonds. But they are struggling to pay. They have a willingness to pay. But they're doing it on a layaway plan, as impoverished citizens of the world do all over the world. They're paying a little bit each month. Interestingly, that plan had been followed by another company for much the same reasons. Its gold mining operation was seized by Chavez in the 2000s. They were awarded by the International Court, not as much as Crystalex. They were awarded $750 million. But Venezuela finally started paying them after years and years of litigation and tracking them all over the world and going to the Court of Appeals in the United States several times to a settlement where they pay $29.5 million every month. They started in June. So they're on an installment plan. But interestingly, we learned also over the Thanksgiving holidays, while bad news tends to get buried, that Gold Reserve, this Canadian and U.S. company, has been unable to get its money out of Venezuela. That last three payments of $29.5 million a month, so $88.5 million out of Venezuela because of the sanctions, that no banks want to deal with Venezuela. So now they have $88.5 million and more coming, supposedly, stuck in Venezuela that they can't get out. So they're back in the same boat, essentially.
Well, this doesn't sound good or sustainable, for that matter. And it will be, I'm sure, something we'll be talking about for a while as the unraveling of the Venezuelan economy continues, obviously with horrific costs and other trauma for the people of the country. Let me turn to another subject in your portfolio. Honduras, Russ Dallin, has had an election. There has yet to be a final outcome announced, as I understand it, but it sounds as though the incumbent is going to be defeated. Tell us who that is and what the implications might be, both for the country and perhaps for the region, if he is defeated.
Well, the Honduran television presenter, his name is Salvador Nasralla, has been claiming the victory. The official results have not been given. The initial results show that Nasralla has 45.17% of the vote against 40.21% for the incumbent, the president, Juan Orlando Hernandez. But they only have 57% of the vote so far counted. The European Union has just actually come out and criticized the delay in getting the results. But unfortunately, when you're dealing with a rural and third world Latin American country, they're not given to having complete computer technology, and they do have to count ballots by hand. That also leaves room for cheating as well. So no official decision has been made yet, and we're not necessarily expecting an official decision until Thursday. But at the moment, it looks like the leftist candidate may be in the win.
And again, what would that mean for the policies of the country, and most especially, given our audience is here in the United States, for our interests in that part of the world?
It's not good. Appearing by his side has been other former leftist presidents who were tossed out, like Manuel Zelaya, in basically tossed out by the Supreme Court when they tried to make too many leftist moves. It does not bode well. We had seen a rightist movement in many of the governments, from Argentina to Brazil. What we're seeing now is the left is fighting back, both in Honduras as well as Bolivia, where the President Morales is claiming that it's a violation of his human rights that he can't run again because he's constitutionally barred from serving forever.
I remember that as a cardinal human right, perpetual government power. So we'll be, again, obliged to stay on top of this one, and we appreciate what you do in that regard, Russ Dallin, at the Latin American Herald Tribune and in your other capacities, and look forward to a chance to visit with you about all of these things. Perhaps some others coming up, Guatemala and the controversy over the Trump administration's selection of Joseph McManus to be our ambassador to Colombia. But those are for another day. We'll look forward to talking to you soon. Come back to us for sure. I hope the rest of you will do the same tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.